My name is Valerie Ziegler-Morris, and this is a session on early Christians in the Roman Empire. And I have to tell you right now that I'm cribbing some of this from two very famous books, Christian Attitudes Toward Peace and War by Roland Bainton, and that's available in the bookstore if you're interested in it, and a classic book by H. Richard Niebuhr called Christ and Culture, which is in the library but apparently not in the bookstore because it's such a classic that they assume everybody owns it anyway.
It brings it with them at all times.
Yeah, that's right. Personally, I never travel without it. I thought I would just start off asking you for a minute, why is it important to study the early church? People always seem to think that it is. And anytime you want to find out what the Bible really says, which we tried to do last time, people almost always point you to the early church. But why? What's the big deal about early Christians? What makes them significant for us?
They're closer to Jesus.
Yeah. Did you read my notes?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Say that louder, young man.
What a smart student you are.
Say it again.
They're closer to Jesus.
Okay, they're closer to Jesus. So people think, well, okay, I'm having trouble figuring out what my tradition means, but maybe the people who were closest to Jesus had sort of an inside track on it. There are other reasons, too. Can you think of any other reasons why the early church is often considered important? What kind of stuff was going on in the early church?
I think they were groups that had to pull together. They had to be in community because of the persecution around them and the lack of acceptance of their new way of living.
Yeah, that's right. They're really like pioneers trying to figure out what it means to be a Christian. Now, lots of times when we want to figure out what it means to be a Christian, what's the thing that we're most likely to check to get some ideas about?
Other books.
Okay, other books. Maybe especially one book.
Christ and Culture.
First you check Christ and Culture. Then there's another book that you probably sang songs about in Sunday school.
The Bible.
Yeah, the B-I-B-L-E. Yeah, the Lutheran Book of Worship. That's
which is the same as Christ and Culture.
Which is your entry into the Bible. Yeah, that's right. You have to remember, when these early Christians were trying to figure out what it is that they were supposed to be doing and how they were living, they didn't have a New Testament to turn to. They were writing the New Testament, collecting it, and making decisions about what went into it. So they're really important because they're the community from which we get the Bible. Also, let's see, how many Protestants in here? I'm guessing almost. Yeah, how many Catholics? One Catholic. All right. Two Catholics? Okay. Catholics use the Bible too, and always have. But
no.
But Protestants often think that they're a people of the book. And in fact, every time somebody wants to do a big reform of the church, what do they go back to? Huh? Luther, of course, and Christ and Culture. No. What did Luther appeal to when he talked about
sola scriptura?
Sola scriptura. Especially people want to figure out, gosh, how did those early Christians really live? You know, if I could get a handle on how they lived, then I would have a handle on how I should live. And so, yeah.
Would you just define early Christians? I mean, what period are you talking about?
Okay, to start off with, I'm going to talk about Christians up to the year 312. That'll be the first half. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about Christians after the year 312. But lots of times people think the apostolic community, the first generation or first two generations, are really important. Because, you know, they're our guides in a way. They're the ones who knew Jesus or knew people who knew Jesus. They're the ones who wrote the scriptures, brought them together, made decisions about what was really Christian and what wasn't. And every time people want to reform the church, or at least many times, especially Protestants, whenever Protestants think that things are really going rotten in the church as they know it, what do?
New Testament Christianity.
Yeah, that's right. New Testament Christianity. In fact, there are some Protestant denominations that claim to be restorationist Christians. Like, you probably don't run into Church of Christ too much where you
are.
Oh, you do?
In the disciples.
Okay, disciples. Probably even more than disciples, Church of Christ. Okay, you run into them. The theory is it's a straight New Testament church. Also, if you know any Mennonites, Mennonites are really serious about recapturing New Testament Christianity. Okay, so that's why most people think that if you want to figure out what it is to be a Christian, especially for us, what we're talking about, how to be a Christian in the world, to live in a country and to be a citizen, yet to know that you have an identity that's not just being a citizen, but also being something else, being a Christian. You look at the early church, yeah.
Just to add something to that, I think one of the other reasons that what's part of that same reason is that you discover that there's no consensus in the early Christians about what it does mean. And in fact, you find that there are a lot of ideas about that that we sort of identify now as the more necessarily maybe more radical ideas about that we think are new, and in fact some of them go back to large groups of people but then in some of these councils and decisions were sort of squashed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we've only gotten sort of in the mainstream a fairly mainstream or conservative idea, and we get this idea that this is the way all the theology and all the Christians live at that time, instead of realizing that there's all sorts of strains that are not new now at all. They really go back to some of
the earliest
traditions.
And that basically captures my message this evening. Everybody has read my notes.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, they had kind of a flood of general ideas, and they hadn't gotten into all the Trinitarian and the Christological, heavy theological things where everybody needs to have 12 years of college to discuss Christianity.
It's sad, but it's true, yeah.
Also, there was no quote-unquote church,
yeah,
at least in the period, the first half that you're talking about.
There were communities.
Yeah. Christians before the church.
Sort of frightening. Okay, now some of you were here on Thursday, all right, when we looked at biblical views of the church or the community of faith and how it's related to the government. And I'm going to put you on the spot, all right? What did we talk about when we talked about the Old Testament? Remember, you had the little crypt sheets and everything. What was the model of government that we looked at in the Old Testament? Dan, you know.
Where are your notes?
Maybe I should pass the crypt sheet back out.
Kingship.
Yeah, kingship. Okay, real good. Kingship. We talked some about holy war and the prophets and judges and all that kind of stuff. And we got into kingship. And remember, the king had a very special relationship with God. The king was sort of anointed as God's son, and no one else was in that relationship with God. The king had a lot of power, but the king also had to do something else. Remember what the something else was?
He had to take care of the poor.
Yeah, the king had to care about justice, to obey the covenant, that Israel was a covenant people. So the king couldn't just make it all up. He had to establish order. That's always part of what government does. But the king had to care about justice. The Old Testament really stresses the poor, the oppressed, the widows, the orphans. That's a big part of what the king was supposed to be doing, caring for those people. Right, then we looked at the New Testament. Can you remember anything that we saw in the New Testament?
Chaos. Chaos.
Okay. Views. We saw a lot of different views. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Including Romans 13.
Okay, we saw Romans 13. Anybody know what Romans 13 says? Right offhand? Someone nodded in the back.
No government exists except by the authority of God.
All right. And those who obey the government obey God. Yeah, pretty straightforward there. Paul doesn't even talk much about justice in that passage. Doesn't really talk at all about justice. He talks about order. And that God cares for people, wishes their lives to be ordered. So Paul really lays a trip on people to respect the government and obey it. What else did we see there? There was another chapter 13 that we looked at.
Oh yeah, Revelation.
Yeah, Book of Revelation. And what's the deal with the state there?
It's a beast.
Yeah, the state is the beast who demands false worship of Christians and who persecutes them. So what are Christians supposed to do then, according to Revelation 13?
Endure.
Endure. That's right. Stay faithful. Endure. Doesn't tell people to revolt. Tells them to endure. But it doesn't have a very high view of the state. The state is demonic. It's in control of the beast. It's not God's goodwill for the creation anymore, but it doesn't tell people to rebel. What about Sermon on the Mount? What do you get out of the Sermon on the Mount? Real famous passages like return no one evil for evil.
Turn the other cheek.
Turn the other cheek.
Love your enemy.
Love your enemy. seems to really be pushing people to live according to a very high ethic. And early Christians were super impressed with the example of Jesus, who to them seemed to have embodied the Sermon on the Mount. Because when Jesus was oppressed, he didn't return evil for evil. He loved his enemies, he respected the state, and rather than return the violence that was put upon him with violence, what did he do? Well, he went to the cross. Yeah. Rather than use means that were unethical, fighting violence with violence, Jesus instead followed the Sermon on the Mount. He loved his enemies. He refused to return evil for evil. He went to his death rather than return violence for violence. We also talked about 1 Peter 2, where the author tells us that Christians are a holy people, a royal priesthood, a special nation called apart. And we talked about Acts 5:29, where Peter says that people ought to obey God rather than human beings. So if someone asks you to do something that's against the faith, you can't do it. You just refuse. All right, let me ask you a question about government. What does government do? I mean, not in broad theoretical terms like a political scientist would say, but in your life.
It restricts the spread of evil.
Okay, uh-huh.
That's believe it or not.
Yeah, believe it or not, government does do that.
It taxes the people.
Okay, it taxes the people. What's it do with taxes?
Provide services that individuals cannot.
Yeah, that's right. It, for example, well, I guess,
schools.
Yeah, schools.
Highways.
Highways, yeah, especially highways. Not just interstates either, but any kind of road. Roads are great. You saw what it's like to get to Holden, you know. Imagine if the whole country were like that. People just riding along in private boats or whatever, you know, what would they do in the desert?
Dig a canal.
Roads are really important. And government does sort of control evil. You know, as bad as we think things are sometimes, gosh, when your house is broken into, you're usually pretty glad to call the police. You know, you don't much like to see the police when you're speeding, but everybody's pretty glad to call them when they lose something that they possessed. Government usually does something else too.
Provide services.
Okay, services.
Water, lights.
Sewage. Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Defense.
Okay, defense.
It used to provide for the poor somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
That's a political statement.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay.
Government also supports, or doesn't necessarily establish, but it supports cultural norms, societal norms. It pays you or gives you dividends for being, conforming
mm-hmm.
to the norms of society.
Yeah, that's right.
That's for sure.
That's definitely for sure. Ask the Berrigans if you think it isn't.
Yeah.
Defense.
Regulatory agencies and various.
Uh-huh, regulatory agencies. Sometimes when we're being regulated, we think they're picky, but like when we go to the store and we hope that the food is clean, we think it's a good idea to have regulatory agencies.
Supports the farmers. Helps.
Supports.
Help the milk.
Supports or, you know, whatever for the farmers.
Now we're getting really heavy into mine. Yeah. Sure.
Research for health and welfare.
Research for health and welfare.
Get back to defense.
Yeah, back to defense. I think usually when Christians talk about government, they also talk about sin. And the fact that we don't live in a perfect world anymore, at least. That people do violent things against one another. And most of us are glad to have police to protect us from that. Also, one state threatens to do violent things to another state. And most people are happy to have an Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine to protect them from that. Not everybody, but most people think that that's part of what government does. So government does good things for people, provides services, protection, also I think a certain amount of coercion. If you break the law, you suffer. Government coerces us not to break the law and tries to coerce other states not to invade us or threaten us. All right. Early Christians, for the first 3 centuries, by and large, were pacifist. And there is no record of Christian participation in the military prior to the year 180. All right? And the reason Christians wouldn't be in the military was because they thought it was wrong to kill. They valued human life that highly. So for an early Christian, say a soldier maybe in the Roman army who met Christians, began to be interested in the faith, decided that perhaps he wanted to join that community, he would have to leave the army because Christians didn't kill people. Now, if you were a magistrate in the Roman Empire, even some little flunky kind of job, and you wanted to be a Christian, in the early years, you'd have to leave your job. Because again, government does good things for us. And early Christians always said that in that sense it was good. But government also coerces people. All right, sometimes it does good things by threatening us. And it doesn't serve Christ. So early Christians said, you know, if you want to be a Christian, then you can't be part of a group that coerces people and uses violence. If you want to be a Christian, you need to leave your government job.
Could there be something else there? The Roman government demand that the people who work for them would honor the emperor as God?
Yeah, and not just the people that worked for them either. Everyone in the empire.
I mean, that was, if they were going to hold a position, they had to do that.
Yeah, definitely, yeah, if you wanted to have a government position. And Christians said, you know, we really do honor the emperor. And the one thing they really loved about the Roman Empire was the roads. You know, Rome had great roads. And roads were great for early Christians because, can you guess? No. It's not quite the Lone Ranger model.
Trips to the Holy Land.
Yeah, how could you make a trip to the Holy Land? To spread the faith. All right, it's, you know, okay, those of you who hike know it's really hard to get anywhere around here. But if you had a road and you could ride a horse, it would be a lot easier. And early Christians said, you know, you need to honor the emperor because government does give us order. But the Roman emperor doesn't do that on purpose. He does it inadvertently. So we honor him for what he does, but we can't give him a loyalty and a worship that only applies to God. And so we can't burn incense to the emperor, for example. In the early days, that meant not being a magistrate. It also meant, for many Christians, something far more terrible, which, you know, the stories about the early Christians and the lions, all that kind of stuff. Actually, they're true. Many early Christians were persecuted because they wouldn't offer incense to the emperor. And in fact, early Christians said, well, you know, that's not surprising at all. We honor the emperor, we obey the authorities, just like Paul said, but there's a sense in which we're a people apart. We're really different from what Rome is all about. And so the people that early Christians admired the most were the martyrs. The best way to be a Christian was to be a heroic Christian, to be a martyr. There's a great story about a guy named Origen. I'm going to talk about again in a minute. Well, Origen has a lot of great stories. He had a sort of an interesting sexual life, which you might want to look up sometime. But when Origen was a kid, he lived in the 2nd century. He belonged to a Christian family, and a big persecution was going on. And the story goes that Origen's father was arrested as a professor of the faith, right? And those people would be taken to jail and be given chances to recant and offer an offering to the emperor. And if they didn't do that, then they would be destroyed in some way. Well, Origen was so angry that his father was picked up and that he wasn't, that his mother hid his clothes from him because he wouldn't go out into the street naked. So she just kept him in the house so he wouldn't offer himself up to be arrested. And finally, he agreed not to offer himself up, and he went down to the prison to visit his father. And there he urged his father not to give in. No matter what happened, his father shouldn't give in. He should just go all the way and be a martyr. In fact, some early Christians wrote about how they longed for the day that the lions tore them to pieces, because then they really would be sharing the life of Christ as he offered himself up, so they would share in that offering. Well, poor Origen's dad, it was pretty tough on him. He felt like he couldn't recant, so he didn't. He died. And early Christians thought that martyrs were the heart of what it meant to be a Christian. Now, some of you probably have read Niebuhr, and you know the name of this category of Christianity. But how would you describe this view of what Christians are? Okay, we've got Christians and the state. How do they relate to one another? Friends? Partners?
Antagonists.
Okay. Antagonists in some ways.
Oblivious in some ways. I mean, until the state, goes against the Christians are simply living oblivious. So, they're not antagonists before the state antagonizes, and even when the state does antagonize, they sort of just take it.
Yeah.
The important thing seems to be the demanding of allegiance. That's where the real problem is, because if the state demands an allegiance beyond the Christian's allegiance to God,
mm-hmm.
then that's where the real problems come, and they are also in modern times too.
Yeah.
For people who face the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Our country has this religious grouping that said we're not going to offer up incense, which we symbolically do by saluting the flag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They suffered for that at the time they started that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, early Christians seemed to think that the most important thing about their personal identity was being a Christian. And they didn't live in a land and a time where people said, oh, of course you're a Christian, you're a Roman, as mm-hmm. I think is often the case for us. Mm-hmm. You know, well, yeah, you live in America, you're probably a Christian. If you're not, it's because you had to sort of become something else.
Yeah.
So many of us are just raised within the tradition. Early Christians weren't raised within a cultural tradition that said, well, of course you're a Christian, you're a Roman. Instead, what was their situation?
Some of them were Jews, of course.
Yeah, of course. And in fact, when Christianity becomes defined as a separate religion, not a part of Judaism, that's when it's no longer a tolerated religion. That's the root of all the persecution. Jews were tolerated. Christians determined that they were not Jews, and therefore they were not a tolerated religion within the empire. Well, let me tell you about a guy named Celsus. Celsus was a Roman who got really tired of the Christians. And he wrote a letter to our guy Origen, and he said, you know, you Christians, you are like parasites. You use the state, all right? You love our roads. You love our peace. You use us, but you won't fight to protect us, and you won't serve in the army. You won't be in the government. So not only will you not protect us, you won't even help maintain us. All right, you're just parasites. You're worthless. In fact, if you ever talk to people about the Amish, you'll often hear people say the same kinds of things about them. That, oh yeah, they're pacifists because, you know, they're just living off American goodness. It's easy for them to be pacifists. They let everybody else do their fighting for them. Well, Celsus was saying the same kind of thing about the early Christians. You know, you're just lazy. We fight for you. We protect you. We write the laws. We put them into practice. We do all the dirty bureaucratic work. And you people sort of, you know, prance around using our roads, spreading your gospel. Origen answered, he said, well, we serve the state better than people in the army or people in the government, but we serve the state by other means. No one, he said, fights better for the king than we do. We do not indeed fight under him, although he required it, but we fight on his behalf, forming a special army, an army of piety, by offering our prayers to God. So Origen said, we're a special people, just like 1 Peter said, a royal priesthood called apart. We're an army of piety. We have a special mission, and it's different and higher than the mission that you people in the government, you people in the army have. Our mission is different, it's better, it's higher, but it's not opposed to you. That is to say, we don't subvert you, and we pray for you, but we're not about the same things that you're about. You sort of assume that there would be a dualism, right? It's one thing to be a citizen and another thing to be a Christian. And the name that Richard Niebuhr gives this category is, he calls it Christ against culture. When Christians assume that the state really falls below the perfection of Christ, that Christ calls us to a higher life, that's what the Sermon on the Mount is all about, and that people in the state live according to a lower ethic. They return evil for evil. They deal in the ways of the world. They need to be converted. So Christians don't, it's not that they oppose the state or try to overthrow it, but they're uneasy in their culture. They don't belong there. They're a separate people, a people called apart. What do you think about that model? I think it's very different from the usual assumptions that we make. But let me get some reactions to that. How do you feel about that? Yeah, fair. Do you like it? Does it ring true? Does it sound dumb?
You know, I'm in the late 1800s and probably up through 1910. There was a lot of religious ferment going on in this country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that what we call the social gospel became very prevalent, where they were trying to help the major Protestant churches, trying to help the mainline. We're trying to help the people by social good programs and so forth. And there was a religious movement that came out at this time which basically gave that same argument that you just gave from Origen. And they said, well, yeah, well, we do that too. Mm-hmm. We go into the slums and we pray for the people. And there's quite a reaction that the Protestants had against this religious movement, which did not fit within Protestantism.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, yeah. Well, maybe we should get it on a more personal level. Have you ever felt as though maybe, even though you didn't know the name of this position before now, that maybe being a Christian put you in conflict with the culture around you?
Yeah, just about every day.
just about every day, I see.
Occasionally, I find myself in conflict with my church on some basic Christian matter.
Like what?
Well, the latest one was on the ordination of women.
Mm-hmm.
The Episcopal Church is way behind the Lutherans on that. And it was a very painful and time-consuming and ego-battering issue. Mm-hmm. And it lasted, and women who were for it were really quite persecuted. Mm-hmm. So I know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
The student era of Vietnam certainly was a clash.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Especially if you lived in a university town like I did.
That's right. Or even if you were here at the session at 4, when they were talking about being Peace Corps volunteers in Costa Rica, that on the one hand they were volunteers trying to help people develop their own resources, and they were representatives of this country. But at the same time, the Army Corps of Engineers was building roads to help transport military material. And they were representatives of this country as well. And it put the volunteers in sort of a funny position. They weren't sure quite what they were representing when they were representing us, this country. Military might, development, personal considerations, you know, it made them feel sort of funny. Do you feel that the fact that this is the position of the early church, does that put any kind of claim on us? All right, you know, we go to scripture, we found that scripture was sort of ambiguous. There were a lot of models there. So we said, well, let's see what people did, how they put these models into practice. And now we find that these early Christians are saying, well, we're not really a part of our culture, and we don't even want to be in the government. You know, the government is for sinful people. but we want to follow the Sermon on the Mount. We want to be like Jesus. But, yeah, Gil.
Well, when you say the government's for sinful people. Well, we all sin.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if you'd repeat it again, just for me.
I'll give you an example. Now, everybody in here is sinful, right?
Right.
Okay.
Well.
Most everybody. Except for the virgin born. Most people in here are sinful. All right. How many of you locked the doors to your room? Here.
Can't find a key.
Okay. How many of you lock your houses at home? Yeah, I sure do. If you live in Memphis, you have bars on your windows. There's a difference. All right. That we trust each other as Christians to live.
We trust sinful people here because you won't give us a key.
Talk to the man back there. Don't talk to me.
It's called coercion by government.
Yeah. Brainwashing. That even though, of course, we remain sinful in many, many ways, yet still when we're together here, we trust each other and behave in ways that we know people outside of Holden don't behave. I leave my stuff lying around in the library here. I guarantee you I don't leave it lying around in other libraries. Yeah, go ahead, Gil.
God still loves the people. It would break into our door at home just as much as he loves us hallowed people up here.
Mm-hmm. But the early Christians would say, of course that's true. And what we are seeking to do is incarnate the lifestyle of Jesus so that they too can see that Jesus is Lord and they can follow him. So yes, God loves them and the government serves good purposes for them, but that's not the lifestyle, the highest lifestyle to which they're called.
Did the early church seek to sort of reform the government and participate in any way in the system, or did they just sort of separate themselves and act real piously?
The early church really separated itself. But again, this is a church under persecution, too. I mean, it's not a legal religion. And people are subject to being martyred. If the emperor has a bad day, maybe there'll be a new purge. You just don't know. So they didn't have all the options that we have, and clearly they lived in just a really different situation. But yeah,
they probably did after Constantine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
after Constantine things get real different. Maybe we should move to that so we have a comparison. Yeah, in 312, a miracle happened. Susan, you want to tell us what it was?
Constantine converted.
Uh-huh.
And converted the entire Roman Empire.
Yep.
Or decreed that from then on the Roman Empire.
Constantine converted in 312. In 313, he issued the Edict of Milan, which made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. And that meant literally for some Christians within their lifetime, they went from being persecuted, from being willing to give their lives, and they saw friends and relatives give their lives for the faith. They went from that to being the status quo. They went, just an incredible shift. I can't even think of anything that it would be like. I can't even think of a modern example. They went from being criminals, people who were subject to death, to being the people who sort of ran things. If you were Roman, of course you were a Christian, because Christianity was the religion of the Roman Empire. And as early Christians thought about that, they said to themselves, this is the work of God. This is a number one ever-loving miracle because we've lived it. We've seen it. We saw people die hideous deaths for the faith. And now, the greatest government that the world has ever known espouses Christianity. And our chance to proselytize the whole world, really to bring the gospel to every corner of the earth, is enhanced. I mean, it's the greatest thing that ever could happen. Maybe like you were talking earlier, it would be the difference for people who really care about peace and justice issues, might be the difference between a nation that sort of allows a country to be filled with homeless people who have very little resources, a nation that said, you know, that's wrong and we're just going to change it. We're going to be different people. And so the nation became a place where people weren't hungry, where the poor were cared for. I mean, I think for you that would be an enormous change in how you feel about this country. For the early Christians, it was a miracle. You know, just a miracle. And they tended to say, well, you know, what the emperor does, you shouldn't criticize too much because you don't want to mess with the machinery. All right, God has given us this miracle and allowed the church to be the religion of the greatest government on earth. Wherever that government goes, it brings the gospel with it. And so our job is to serve that government. And now Christians feel no qualms about being in the army, serving in the government, because everything that Rome does is a witness to the faith that it proclaims. And Niebuhr calls this position, any guesses? They all start with Christ, except for one, they all end in culture. The Lutheran position would be different. Anybody want to guess the preposition?
Four.
Four, yeah, four is close. He calls it Christ of culture. And I might also say, we've seen this before. We didn't call it Christ, but we've seen this kind of position, where being a believer and being a citizen are really one and the same. Where did we see it?
Old Testament.
Yeah, we saw it there. So, I mean, you know, literally within some people's lifetimes, the whole ballgame got shifted completely.
Question?
Yeah, go for it.
Do we have a historical period in America where we kind of felt it was based on culture or... Where America went, you know,
took
the gospel.
Oh, boy. I'll let you answer your own question. What do you think?
Well, I just wonder if we have a historical period where a lot of the church felt that. A lot of the Christians felt that. I mean, you're talking about an area of period.
Yeah, I think the place you would really see that would be in the Manifest Destiny movement in the 19th century, where religion and the flag sort of followed each other, especially, you probably all had to take American history in school and remember McKinley's decision on whether or not to annex the Philippines. You know, he got down in his bedroom and he prayed and he said, I just felt like God was telling me to make our little brown brothers Christians, so we're going to take them over.
Protestant Christian.
Yeah, Protestant Christian. Again, but you know, what does that assume? You know, it assumes that at least for his day, where the government sent troops and where those troops conquered people and brought them into American influence, that also meant not just American but Christian influence. Well, how do you feel about this position? Was it a miracle? If you're Mennonite, this is the great betrayal.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it might have been a good trick. See, sort of went over all the Christians. Kind of a dirty trick. I think it's
a kind of a dirty trick.
Yeah.
Well, he himself was converted, right? He it seems like his conversion had some integrity, personal. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting because the other emperors couldn't get him to burn incense. And he said, fine, you know, I and everybody else is going to worship God. And he got the whole empire to worship But it is much different than worshiping the emperor, because you're still...
Yeah, and the emperor, I mean, we still got Romans 13. I mean, the emperor is sort of God's main man here. And now this whole empire is an expression of Christian culture. Before the two were opposed, now they're together.
I always have a problem with the Christ of culture model, insofar as I think it has been, I mean, historically used as a justification, like the McKinley story you told. How many stories can we think of throughout history where the act of a government has been justified by what it purports, its purported direction from God, the holy war concept, the American government, the American civil religion, the way that we have justified so many things because we're supposedly an almost chosen people ourselves. And so I'm a little bit more comfortable with Christ against culture, where that creative friction there can and the standing outside and being a strong voice of criticism and standing for something, then what I think Christ of culture can be perverted and has been perverted as.
Well, and the way the critique that you'd make is to say that, well, in fact, in 312, nothing happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was simply that Constantine said, we're not going to shoot these guys anymore, but nothing happened that really brought Christ into the hearts and minds of the people of the empire. And that it was simply a bureaucratic decision, mm-hmm, about who you're gonna kill, or stop killing.
Yeah.
So I think that would be an argument that there isn't really a movement here to Christ of culture if you have a high understanding of what,
mm-hmm,
Christ means.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if at any point when a civilization stops persecuting Christians, you suddenly have a Christ of culture, then you'd have a low sense of what that means. I mean, if the Soviet Union stops persecuting the people who go to church, do you then have a Christ of culture? Well, no.
No, but you'd be closer to it if the Soviet Union then claimed to be a Christian nation.
Possibly, yeah. But it does smack of co-optation, mm-hmm, of just sort of trying to take, mm-hmm, over what Christianity means or dilute it.
Yeah. I think it's a lot harder to maintain your integrity whenever you're just, like, there's just a blanket exception of Christianity.
Mm.
So things got a lot watered down.
Yeah, watered down so that everyone can share in it. Gil, what do you think about this one? Because you weren't too comfortable. You didn't like that first. Yeah, I think you're the only, what is it, gladsome Gil, gleeful Gil?
That's close enough.
Gleesome Gil.
Well, what she said, it's so, you know, every other word, I've got to think, now what does all that mean?
And, yeah,
you know,
what does it mean?
A long time since I've done what some of you people are, you know, just children, and, you know, and I can't remember some of these words. But I keep still most of the time, so I'll let it go.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you at another session. What you are rightly suspecting, Sherry, is that some people did feel that, gosh, if everybody was a Christian, it didn't mean much to be a Christian. And they remembered back to the good old days when people died for the faith. And for them, that increasingly came to be what it really is to be a Christian. A real Christian is someone entirely revolving his or her life around the faith. And we get a movement called, anybody, monasticism that comes,
mm-hmm,
from this. St. Anthony's the most famous one. You know, just going through church, Jeff was talking the other night, he heard the scripture, go sell all your goods, give to the poor, and come follow me. And so Anthony did. He also gave away his sister. At first he didn't give everything away. He left some stuff for her, but then he felt bad about it, so he came back and he gave her away too. Sent her off to live with some righteous virgins.
No and, kidding.
Mm-hmm. He went to the desert. And Athanasius, a famous early Christian, wrote what he called a life of Antony. Antony was like so famous for his piety that people went to the desert to see Antony. And what was incredible about Antony was that he lived a really self-denying life. I mean, like he ate, you know, once a week, if he thought about it. And he just prayed all the time, and he battled demons, and he became a person, Athanasius tells us, of utter equilibrium. In fact, Athanasius said, to see Antony was to see Jesus, that Christ was so strong in him that to know Antony was to know Jesus. And other people started going off into the desert because they saw the kind of life that Antony had. And they said, Christians at home are boring. Everybody's a Christian, but they don't have any power in their lives. And so men and women went to the desert to live ascetical lives, lives of great self-denial. And that pacifism that the early Christians had, that gets passed along to the deserts. The monks and the nuns maintain that pacifism. And eventually the priests do too. Remember in all the movies, the priests don't fight. They just like carry the weapons for the people who do, but the priests never fight. But think for a minute, what did that do to the early church? At first, the Christ against culture model, there was a real dualism that we could see, and that dualism was Christ against culture, Christians against other people. Now there's a new kind of dualism with the rise of monasticism and heroic Christianity. And now where's the dualism? Yeah, it's in the church between heroic Christians who live a particular, really rigorous, hard kind of life, and other Christians, cultural Christians, who just sit around and, you know, do whatever. Or that's how it looks to the people in the desert anyway. So the ambiguity never goes away. It's always there. Always an ambiguity between commitment and being comfortable. Christians always want to be committed. They also always want to live in fellowship with those around them. And yeah, Barry, were you going to say something? Oh, don't breathe like that then. Yes. Poor Gil, I mean, he's never going to come back. He's going to sit in the back if he does anyway. Well, who was right? Which early Christians had it?
Look at that split in our denominations now.
Oh yeah, these things don't go away. They just multiply. Because both sides are making some kind of sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm old enough to remember a few years before the rest of you here, most of you at least. When I was growing up, I never heard the word Christian mentioned in our home. My father, my mother, my brother, and myself. Never Christian. We were Lutheran.
Right, not Christian, but Lutheran.
Now, believe you me, my dad and mom, well, they're dead. But gee, if I could talk to them today, I would, you know, as a mature man, I would like to hear their reaction to that statement. Talk about changes going on. Changes in my little life. Blows my mind.
Yeah, I used to have a friend in college who was Presbyterian, and I always said that she wasn't Christian, she was Presbyterian.
Yeah.
And it was true.
Sharon and I were discussing Vespers the other day that we were both raised Catholic, and when you were raised Catholic, there were only two kinds of people in the world. There were Catholics and publics.
Uh-huh.
Public? And the publics where everybody went to the public school.
Public school, yeah.
And so there were Catholics and there were publics, and you didn't distinguish between publics, they were just publics.
Publics, yeah.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Now see, we had fish eaters and us.
That's That's what it looked like from the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, uniforms. They were always off wearing uniforms and getting holy days off. Yeah. Well, now, when we quit talking about the Bible, we never had an answer. Do we have more of an answer here? Or is this just too upsetting?
You know, in a way, I think it's more upsetting for people who were born and raised as Christians, you know, born into a Christian home and grew up with Christian teaching and Sunday school and everything. I came to Christ as an adult. So none of this is upsetting to me at all, mm-hmm. you know, because I already had my values and my ethical system set as an adult. And then all of a sudden, Jesus happened into my life. And it was a marvelous thing. My life totally turned around and all that. But still, I was the same person who I had been. I was just living a little differently. So it's not so hard for me to understand this because I chose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I also chose to give up a lot of good friends who weren't, because we were just going different paths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so cultural Christianity was never an option for you.
Huh. It never was. I never associated with Christians before I became one. So this all is very easy for me to understand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
I don't know. I guess it's always easy for us to think that we're right and everyone else is wrong. And mm-hmm. and I guess I kind of feel that way about the church today, that, you know, there's a lot of that cultural Christianity going on. It doesn't have a lot of integrity, and it's more of a tradition than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe the desert, I'm not convinced that either one of those are right, but maybe the desert people were a little bit more.
Oh, I will say, I go to a church in Memphis that is the most active church in ministry to the poor. And when I talked about these models in the adult Sunday school class there, the vast majority of the people said that they felt very comfortable in the Christ of culture position. Mm-hmm. The reason they said that was that they believe that they saw Christ in each and every person, especially the poor people who come to the church for love and support. And because they saw Christ everywhere in the culture, they felt called to serve Christ.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't, well, every position has good things and bad things about it, but we should say good things about the Christ of culture position too.
Yeah, I was gonna say that it seems to me that what we're called to do as Christians in any situation is to have a proactive stance. And when you take a proactive stance, whether you're situated in bureaucratic Rome or situated in the desert, the proactive position would cause you to do a number of things that would make you a more vital community. You'd want to be preaching to other people, whether you're Anthony or whether you're a bureaucrat in Rome. You'd want to be taking care of the poor. You'd want to be doing a number of things. So I think there's a kind of reality of being a Christian which forces you to do stuff that cuts across the boundaries. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. 'Cause
you
mm-hmm.
can't just call yourself a Christian and be static. There's something very active about being a Christian that I think we're coming to understand. Look, for example, you can't be a Christian. It says it in the New Testament how do you make Christians except by preaching to them? So there's this activeness. So if someone says, well, I'm a Christian, but I don't go to church, you say, no, you're not a Christian, because you have to be preached to in order to be a Christian. You know what I mean? You're changing the definition of what it means
mm-hmm.
to be Christian.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be some active participation in order for yourself to be a Christian.
But then if you take that model and you then add back into it the relationship of the Christian and the state, then what you are saying is that the proactive stance within the state would require, I mean, let's look at contemporary United States of America. What is, I mean, I'm sure this is going to be, this is stealing some of your thunder, but where do we, how do you be a Christian proactively in the face of the state in contemporary United States of America? I mean, I can't answer the question. Yeah. But I would say
I
don't think it's through preaching.
You don't think so?
Well, I don't think we can settle it now because we need to go to Vespers. I think we can say that both in the scriptures that we looked at and in this period of the early church, people of faith believed that God was acting in history. They didn't always identify that activity the same way, but they did think that God was moving and creating a people. And this Christ of culture model worked pretty well, but it created a lot of problems too. And if you want to know about that and see how they all get hassled out and that kind of thing, you'll just have to come to the next session.